Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Representatives of the Caspian Littoral States met 47th time last week in Tehran to discuss questions surrounding legal status of the sea, which ended with the old commitment saying the discussion to be continued. As the dispute on boundaries of the sea remains, increasing number of the neighboring states are going ahead with individual projects and also strengthening their military presence in the sea. On today's Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly Central Asia podcast, we will discuss reasons behind continued deadlock over the legal regime of the Caspian Sea and changing nature of the dispute. To discuss the subject, from Canada, Dr. Robert Kuttler, energy consultant with Close Eye on the Caspian Sea, is joining us. Dr. Kuttler, good morning.
Good morning.
Hussein Aryan is joining us from UK. He is an Iranian journalist who was formerly BBC editor in Azerbaijan and deputy director of the Radio Farda, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Iranian service. Mr. Aryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Luke Coffey, director of the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, is joining us. Luke also is the author of the recent booklet called A Secure and Stable Caspian Sea is in America's Interest. Luke Coffey, welcome to the Majlis.
Great. It's a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Very nice to have you. And Bruce Panier is joining us today from New York, who is the editor of Kishlak Awazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. So we have a crowded Majlis today. Welcome, gentlemen, again. Before to kick off the debate, just a reminder, please feel free to amplify, expand, or disagree directly with points other guests are making. Please don't wait for me to prompt you a question. So with this, let's start with you, Dr. Kuttler. For years, the discussion over the Eurasian energy has been going on, and there has been talks between Europeans and Central Asians to build pipelines through Caspian Sea. But when you talk about the connecting Central Asia to Europe, you end up always with the dilemma involving the legal regime of the Caspian Sea. So when we talk about the legal status of the Caspian Sea, what we have in mind? Let's start with some background information, Dr. Kuttler.
Well, this problem goes back to the dissolution of the Soviet Union, where there were created three new states, which did not exist at the time when the regime of the Caspian Sea, such as it did exist, was instituted through two bilateral treaties and some additional protocols between first the Russian Republic before the Soviet Union was established and Iran, and subsequently between the Soviet Union and Iran. These dated back to 1920 and 1941, and these agreements did not certainly address or even invoke or conceive the question of the division of the seabed or of the waters of the sea as a whole, and certainly not the question of the exploitation of natural resources under the seabed. They concerned mainly fishing rights and coastal matters. And so the question as posed in legal terms since 1991 is the status of the sea as an inland lake or a sea following the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which set out norms that would be applied in each of the two cases. As is well known, there have been political disagreements amongst the five littoral countries since then as a result of the disputes over the access to and the right to exploit these natural resources, oil and gas, under the sea. And as often is the case, international law becomes an artifact or an implement of national interests, and the opposing national interests have prevented a consensus on the status of the sea.
Right. There has been efforts to come to a resolution on this. Neighbors are talking, but their discussions are going nowhere about resolving the issue. So what are the main causes for this deadlock, Mr. Aryan?
Well, one of the main issues, in my opinion, is the way that Iran looks at the sea. In fact, Iran considers it a sea, hence using the sort of international law and trying to get a bigger share. And that is, I think, the stumbling block, because other countries, including Turkmenistan, are quite happy with the median line or modified median line, and Iran does not accept that.
So what is Russian position here? Lukofi, do you want to jump in?
Russia has had this conflicting position, internally at least, since the early 90s. In the early days, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and then the Ministry responsible for energy and some of the private or some of the oil and gas companies took all differing positions. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs tends to be more supportive of this idea of it being a sea. Hmm. And then the Ministry of Energy is more worried about mineral exploitation, energy exploitation, and so are some of the oil and gas companies. So they want an agreement to be made as soon as possible, and they really don't care what it is as long as it can be done quickly and allow for the exploitation of these resources. This has gradually over the time emerged into a position that is often referred to as common waters divided bottom. Hmm. So with this policy, Russia is able to maintain, you know, surface navigational rights and therefore naval supremacy, which it views very important in the Caspian, while taking a more pragmatic approach to the oil and gas exploration and ownership. I would say over the years, Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan have at least implicitly agreed to this common waters divided bottom approach, since they have signed agreements. Both have signed agreements with Russia back in 2002-2003, I think, on drawing and agreeing national sectors. Hmm. It's in its interest under the current geopolitical circumstances that the region is facing. It's in Russia's interest that this matter remains unsettled. Mm-hmm. This makes it more difficult for, of course, the Trans-Caspian gas pipeline to ever be realized. And it means that there's one less alternative available to Europe that bypasses Russia in terms of providing energy resources. So I don't think you're going to see very much initiative from Moscow in the coming years to really unlock this issue.
But whether with consent of Russia or without consent of Russia, some countries are also taking the initiative to launch bilateral or individual projects. We will get to that subject in the second half of the debate. Now, as far as I can say, other three neighbors, Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, and Kazakhstan, has a shared interest and therefore probably has the same position. Am I correct, Bruce?
Well, yes and no. Obviously, you know, as Dr. Keller pointed out, they weren't part of earlier agreements simply because they didn't exist as countries. You know, in the case of Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan, they have gone ahead and started developing major parts in their sectors of the Caspian Sea already. Turkmenistan, to some degree, also, but not certainly the spectacular success of Shah Deniz. I think, you know, Turkmenistan was always, although they've been developing their own sectors of the Caspian with outside help, I might add, their big project was always going to be this Trans-Caspian pipeline, and that's really the only one that other parties, littoral states, have objected to, specifically Russia and Iran. It's kind of interesting that they make all these statements about, you know, we need to protect the Caspian Sea and the environment and everything like that. But of course, you know, like I said, Shah Deniz and Shah Deniz II now have been going ahead in Azerbaijan and Kashagan. As we know, actually started production a couple years ago and did have pipeline leaks that did affect the ecology and the environment in the Caspian Sea. And no one said anything about that. But then when Turkmenistan raises the possibility of a Trans-Caspian pipeline, all of a sudden here come the objections. So, you know, they have done some development without any resolution to the status of the Caspian Sea. But there's clearly so many political angles at work here. And some of them seem to be able to get away with working on these large projects and others, Turkmenistan specifically, with far less success and numerous objections from, again, Tehran and Moscow.
Mohammed, this is Robert Cutler. Yeah. If I could just throw in as a note to what Bruce just said, that as part of the Russian-Kazakhstani agreements for the division of their mutual boundaries, the modified median line, as was mentioned, that which, by the way, is a norm of international law already well established, a certain way of drawing the line, that the two countries have cooperated and continue to cooperate on a number of joint ventures to exploit deposits that are on or near the boundary of that so-called modified medium line in the Caspian offshore. And they've done that very, very well without a problem, without reference to ecological problems. And one may as well mention that when this Russia built the Blue Stream pipeline under the Black Sea to Turkey, and when it talks about the Turkish Stream pipeline, nobody, and not Russia, really discusses the environmental or the ecological issues which seem to come to the fore rhetorically when Caspian affairs are the subject of discussion.
Then the question is what the Russian position or the Iranian positions, does those arguments make sense, Hossein Aryan?
Well, let me say something, I mean, following, you know, what other guests have said. Iran, you know, with other littoral countries, they signed quite a number of agreements, you know, in terms of protection of maritime resources, security, cooperation, search and rescue, emergency situation. But all of these agreements are connected to the legal status of the Caspian Sea. So some of them, in a way, cannot be really implemented without resolving this status. But in terms of what other guests said, I mean, 60, if I'm right, you know, correct me, any of the guests, about 68 to 70% of the Caspian Sea has already been divided.
How?
You know, between
How?
Russia, between Kazakhstan, between Azerbaijan, and also Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan. So it only leaves something like about 30%, which is, you know, Iran, Azerbaijan, and Turkmenistan. So Iran, I think, is really in a kind of sort of minority situation. And it is, answering your question, is very important that legal status is clarified before the countries, especially Iran, you know, can do something. Turkmenistan, as far as I can see, no way is going to change its mind. Azerbaijan is the same. So we've got only here in Iran. As far as I can see, the legal status is already, and they're all waiting to see whether Iran changes its stance towards the division of the Caspian Sea or not.
Mohammed, if I could follow on from that, and with Iran, they're in an interesting position, in my opinion, because the bit of the Caspian they believe to be theirs is the deepest. I think it holds, in fact, almost two-thirds of the volume of the water in the Caspian. So in terms of extracting oil and gas resources, it's very difficult, and the technology has an advance to the point where it's as profitable or even easy. And for the time being, I think Iran's focus is going to be, in terms of oil and gas production, is going to be elsewhere. It's going to be more focused towards the Gulf and that region. But I think on the back of the Iran deal, Iran has a newfound confidence on the international stage. And I think it remains to be seen how this might impact the negotiations in the region. Rouhani said after the deal that the agreement could be replicated to advance Iran's interests in other regions of the world in a way that he described in what he described as a quote third way unquote for Iranian foreign policy. So if there ever becomes a point where Iran decides that, you know, the Caspian region is going to become a higher priority, I think right now Iran's tied up in the Middle East and with various situations. But if they decide it is a priority, it would be interesting to see how much, you know, effort they would place in trying to advance their interests in that region. As things stand now, I'm not sure if they have the capacity to do so.
Iran does not have the capacity by itself to do so, although it in the past years found its way to obtain technologies for close offshore exploitation from certain European countries. And if I understand correctly, I've seen a report lately that the Astrakhan shipbuilding enterprise in Russia is actually beginning to become hard at work building semi-submersible rigs that will be constructed in Iranian, that will be sunk and the modules completed in Iranian waters.
Can I jump? Yes, it's. I quite agree with the other guests. Yes, Iran's priority definitely lies with attracting foreign investment, with regard to its oil fields in the south. But yes, Iran has, claimed that it's found this new oil and gas field, Sardar-e Janjal, opposite the Gilan province. And as well as help from Russia, also, as far as I know, Iran is also getting some help, including from a Swedish company for these submersible platforms.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I think, Dr. Kutla, you said that when Russia was launching a project under the Black Sea, no one was talking about the environment. But when Turkmenistan or some other small countries wants to do something similar, and then suddenly topic of environment being put on the agenda. So it looks like the argument's mostly political.
I think that that's a fair assessment. It's certainly true that 20 years ago, this was a more significant issue. But since the development of Shah Deniz Phase 1 in particular, which gave rise to the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline, which was the first pipeline in the industry that actually crossed three countries for export to world markets, the technology and the experience of the international companies has grown by leaps and bounds. And while it is true, to some degree perhaps, that the original project for the Trans-Caspian Gas Pipeline in the late 1990s and the early part, which was sponsored by two American companies, that this was, which was engineered out and it's all ready to go, has been for some time, although the technology will be updated and improved, that it was an issue back then, but there's so much more experience with these things, with constructing and managing these sorts of pipelines in the last 20 years, that it really shouldn't be an issue, and it is not a technical issue. It is a political issue.
Mm-hmm. If that's a political issue, then there is no way, these small countries stand a chance to win this political argument against those major powers. So, Lukofi, where Western countries stands in this?
Well, there's very little, I think, in practice that the West can do to unlock this. I mean, I'd almost say there's nothing. Because of other issues in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe, the two biggest players, Iran and Russia, the U.S. and Europe has very little, if any, leverage or credibility. And areas where we might have leverage.
Europe has a stake in this discussion, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Without a doubt, Europe does have a stake. But in areas where Europe might have leverage or the U.S. might have leverage in terms of further implementation of the Iran deal or perhaps reducing economic sanctions in Ukraine or whatever, I'm guessing that Europe and the West is not going to want to spend that political capital to help unlock this crisis this legal dilemma in the Caspian. Without a doubt, it is in Europe's interest to find new markets, alternative markets to Russian oil and gas. Some suggest that these new markets actually might be Iranian. I would say that's probably very short-sighted. That'd be a very short-sighted policy choice at this time, as things currently stand. But it's also in America's interest that Europe has this sort of alternative to Russian oil and gas, because it doesn't take a leap of faith from reality to envision the scenario where, because of Russia cutting off oil and gas to certain European countries, various things happen, and then there become security implications, which have NATO implications, which have U.S. implications. So I think that what the U.S. needs to do is provide public political support for a resolution of the Caspian legal dispute. I think it's in America's interest that it's decided along the lines of the law of the sea. And I think it's also in America's and Europe's interest that the Trans-Caspian Gas Pipeline is realized, that energy resources from Central Asia can get to Europe as an alternative. Mm-hmm. But I'm just not optimistic that it's going to happen, and I don't really believe that we have much leverage right now.
Talking about leverage, I guess some smaller countries like Turkmenistan is frustrated by the level of help that it is getting from European countries. Bruce, I think several months ago you had a chance to speak to one of top EU energy guy in this. So what is the reason behind the hesitant Europe to get on board with those projects in which they have direct interest?
Well, I mean, let's face it, Turkmenistan's foreign policy is not very conducive to working with partners outside the country. The rights record is of course, very problematic for democratic governments to approach them and try to make some kind of, in this case, energy deals or something. So Turkmenistan has not helped itself a lot. And they have, they have this fairly aloof attitude of if you build a pipeline to our gas fields, then we'll give you gas. But they're really not very interested in building the pipeline themselves. We've seen that changed a little bit with TAPI, such as it is. But their position has always been, European partners and Azerbaijan. You get a consortium together. You build a pipeline that comes to Turkmenistan, and then we will happily supply you with gas. And of course, to Turkmenistan's credit, they did build the East-West pipeline, which everyone assumes is going to feed the Trans-Caspian pipeline should it ever be built. I'm going to have to lay some of the blame here right on Turkmenistan's doorstep. That said, the EU has been overly optimistic, I would say, at the chances of getting this done. We know that Shevchovich, their point man for energy issues in the EU, is one of the people predicting Trans-Caspian pipeline by 2019. All the good intentions and hopes in the world are not going to see that pipeline built. And they've been talking about this. They saw Nabucco fall through. Not even quite a decade ago. So I don't know where they can really go with this. If Turkmenistan was a better partner, maybe something would happen. But there's a combination of things that prevent this pipeline from being built. Between Turkmenistan's bad record, its bad history of partnership, the EU not wanting to be too antagonistic toward Russia and seeing that Russia is absolutely opposed to this project. There's so many complications. I can't see it working. Again, Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan don't seem to have much problem exporting their oil and in Azerbaijan's case, their gas too. But when it comes to Turkmenistan, for some reason, there's just a whole different set of issues at work here. And let's face it, Turkmenistan doesn't have a lot of people on their side.
There is also an argument among some people who are attached to the Atlantic Council's Energy Center who says that if Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan agrees to build something, there is no legal obstacle to do so. I'm sorry that we could not have Ambassador Morningstar to talk about this issue. So let's take a short break here. As the Caspian Littoral states continue to argue in favor of their positions, there are definitely winners and losers in the debate. So what is the possible ultimate end to this discussion? We will continue our debate on the Majlis discussing this and the other possible consequences and scenarios surrounding the Caspian Sea. Let us recap the debate. Today, joining the Majlis are Dr. Robert Kotler, International Energy Consultant, who's joining us from Canada today, Hussein Aryan, Iranian journalist and analyst who has previously served in Azerbaijan and Iran, currently based in UK, is joining us. Luke Coffey, Director of Douglas and Sarah Ellison Center for Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, is joining us from Washington, D.C., and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, is joining us today from New York. I'm Mohammed Tahir here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, gentlemen. As I was saying in the first half of the debate, the last gathering in Tehran was 47th meeting of the Caspian Littoral State. Clearly, the discussion is going nowhere. So some countries are taking the initiative to launch individual or bilateral projects involving the Caspian Sea without consent of other neighbors, latest of which is the ongoing negotiations between Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan. They are talking to build 739 kilometers long oil pipeline under the sea. First, let's talk about the details of this. Dr. Kotler, you just had a story on this subject. What is that we are talking about here?
Thank you. Pick up briefly before discussing that, your point about the position of some people in the Atlantic Council. I'm not affiliated with the Atlantic Council, but I have argued for years professionally that Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan do not need the agreement of other countries in order to build a pipeline, since they adjoin. That is a very viable position in the current situation. There are political obstacles within Turkmenistan to doing that, and also within the Caspian Sea. But that, you're absolutely correct that although it's the TCGP, the Trans-Caspian Gas Pipeline, that gets most of the attention, if not all of the attention, when such projects are under discussion. There is another one that has been under the radar for some time, which is a pipeline, an oil pipeline, between Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan, which they've been discussing for 10 years, and which they again recently, just last month, signed yet another accord for the intention to build. This was originally developed between the two countries. A project was developed when, at a time when, the Caspian Pipeline Consortium pipeline, which takes Tengiz oil from Kazakhstan to the Russian Black Sea port of Novorossiysk, when Russia had been blocking the expansion of that pipeline, which they ceased to block, and the expansion is underway and almost fully completed, a double for that. And Kazakhstan was looking for another route to export its Tengiz oil. Now, since that problem was solved, it was still recognized that the Kashagan oil from the offshore would also need to, more than one market. And as we know, the development of Kashagan has been postponed and postponed and postponed. But as Bruce Panier said earlier, they have begun, just in the last month or two, the commercial production after the replacement of the pipes that had been rusted by the high sulfur content of the oil that they should not have been, which were not up to spec in the first place. But now that's underway. And once Kashagan comes online, as it is already, there will be little incentive to restrict its expansion because of all of the sunk costs by the participants in the consortium. So this TCOTS, Trans-Caspian Oil Transport System, that Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan had made a project for a decade ago, is on the discussion again. And it consists of is two links. It consists of an overland pipeline from Eskenet to Kurik, which is going south inside Kazakhstan. The oil would come onshore from Kashagan, then be transported to the port of Kurik, which is already under construction. Well, it's under expansion because it's going to become a multimodal port for the transport of not just oil to Azerbaijan, to the Alat port of Azerbaijan, which is multimodal, in which they're taking as a model for development. And then what's planned is the Trans-Caspian oil pipeline under the Caspian Sea from Kurik in Kazakhstan, near the Aktau port, to Baku, from where the oil would go, first of all, into the BTC pipeline to the Turkish Mediterranean coast. It would be taken across Georgia, across Azerbaijan and Georgia by rail, and from there it would go by tanker to Odessa in Ukraine, and all the way, it's a bit of a long story, but eventually all the way into Poland and reaching world markets by export from Gdansk. So that is the other pipeline that's kind of under the radar, the TCOP, the Trans-Caspian Oil Pipeline, which is the undersea pipeline component of this two-part transport system.
I think it's worth pointing out to the listeners that there is a big difference between how you can transport and ship natural gas and oil. And that's why I think there's this disproportionate focus on the gas pipeline, because shipping LNG, liquefied natural gas, I'm told anyway, is only profitable after about 2,000 kilometers. And obviously the distance between Turkmenbashi and Baku is just over, you know, 230 or so kilometers.
Hussein Aryan, the pipeline that Dr. Kutler mentioned, the way it stands, the way it sounds, seems to be an undersea pipeline project, exactly the type of project Turkmenistan was being prevented from building for years. So the way it stands, this pipeline, you know, where does this fit into the question of demarcation or disputed nature of the sea?
Well, as far as Iran is concerned, Iran says that because we, you know, literal countries do not have consensus on the legal status of the Caspian Sea, therefore, it's, you know, against this pipeline, because simply they said, you know, we have to agree. At the same time, Iran in the past actually opposed the unilateral agreements between Russia, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, and between Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan on the division of seabed. But at the same time, I would like to mention this point that since the problem of the nuclear issue has been resolved in Iran and there's been a sort of very relative, you know, opening, they've been talking a lot now in Iran that, you know, as well as swap, you know, from the littoral states through Iran, we can also have a pipeline and take the oil to the Persian Gulf or to the Gulf of Oman. Even this point was mentioned at the 47th session of the working group by Foreign Minister Zarif, you know, sort of reminding the representatives that, you know, Iran is open for business. You can send your oil through Iran. And at one point I would like to mention here is Iran has been recently, for the last 3 or 4 years, focusing a lot on a little port called Jos, which is on the east of Bandar Abbas in the Sea of Oman, trying to develop that and wants to turn that into some kind of oil terminal, sort of parallel to the Kharg Island in the Persian Gulf. And
to do what?
Jos port will be in the Oman, hoping, if it's going to be materialized, that some oil and commodities and other things from Central Asian countries or littoral state can go through this port. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in the light of these developments, maybe this question goes to you, Dr. Kutler. In the light of these developments, the development of Kashagan oil field and the oil pipeline that you mentioned being built with involvement of Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan and Russia, so if Turkmenistan wants to come back to its plan to build the Trans-Caspian pipeline, what is the legal argument to stop it?
The legal argument to stop it is that the proper legal regime for the Caspian Sea is one that requires universal consent for the construction of such a pipeline.
But again, they are already in violation of that, Russia, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, isn't it?
Yes and no. They contradict that argument. I would say that they're not in violation of it because it's not a norm, and technically you can only be in violation of an established norm. But they're proceeding in their own way, and this is the way that international law frequently works, is that if the countries concerned go their own way, and then what their practice is formalized in a new international norm. Now, it so happens that the three countries, which have the trilateral, first the three bilateral, then the trilateral agreement, as that you mentioned, Russia, Azerbaijan, and Kazakhstan, are following an established international norm. There are different international norms that can be applied to the situation, and the argument goes over which ones are the proper ones.
Interesting. So as the meeting on legal states of Caspian neighboring states continues without any resolution, and some individual projects are being launched without consent of other neighboring countries, we are also witnessing increasing military activity in the sea, latest of which was Russia firing a rocket to Syria from its naval bases in Caspian Sea. What else Russia has been doing in terms of military in the sea?
Well, I mean, they've really been the backer of many of the regional training exercises. They pull everyone together. It's clearly a Russian-led, for the most part, they're Russian-led exercises. They establish the scenario, and they're designed to show the neighboring countries that Russia is the main power. And I think, you know, most of the regional countries, certainly Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan, are probably thinking, yeah, okay, we can live with this. We just want to produce oil and gas and get it to the world market. Where I think in the future we might have an issue, it could be with Iran. As Iran finds its new role in the world post the Iran deal, and it becomes perhaps less reliant on Russia on the international stage as it was during the Iran deal, during the nuclear deal negotiations, we might see Iran and Russia kind of default back to the regional competition in around the Caspian region and the South Caucasus and other parts of perhaps Central Asia that we saw that was typical during, you know, centuries past. So, you know, do I think that there's going to be a war breaking out because of, the Caspian legal dispute? Not at all, not even close. But there runs the risk of a misunderstanding between the various countries that could lead to conflict on a local level that could maybe spiral out into a bigger crisis. But I think that's probably unlikely.
If I could ask Luke Coffey, you know, just being playing devil's advocate, I'd like to ask his view whether it is not at least as likely that the smaller or the less endowed with population countries in the region would in fact find themselves subject to a Russian-Iranian condominium. There seems to be, although there's no clear document that of cooperation in a grand strategy scheme between Russia and Iran. And I add parenthetically, you're absolutely correct, and I agree with you, that Iran will be less dependent upon Russia than it has been in the past as it reemerges onto the world stage. But as you know, the Russian Federation, Iranian cooperation is very well established, and it goes deep into the ministries of the government, and it antedates that back even into the Soviet period, as I know that you know also. So what is it not at least as likely, looking at the South Caucasus, for example, that they cooperate together in order to squeeze, or in order to not to impose their will, but although they've been doing that in the Caspian Sea, but that the danger is not so much overt conflict between them for the countries in the region, but being squeezed between them.
Well, and that's actually a very good point, which probably doesn't help your case of being a devil's advocate, because I do agree with a lot of that, especially in the context of what we were just discussing about, well, what would be legal about Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan finally constructing and bringing online the Trans-Caspian gas pipeline? Well, nothing would be illegal, but there are a lot of other things that could prevent this from happening, like political pressure, security pressure, military pressure from Russia, in both Russia and Iran. And right now it's in both of their interests to keep this pipeline from happening, probably for different reasons. You know, Iran is dead set on this idea that it's the Caspian Sea is a lake because, under the terms of the law of the sea, they would only get about 13% of the water, whereas they want an equitable 20%. Russia, for different reasons, views this legal status differently from Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan. But they could find this common ground where they can cooperate and work together to keep this from happening. Now, how much of this would be have like a military or security dimension? I'm not so sure it would have to escalate to that point. I think that especially Russia has levers that it can pull in other regions, whether it's, you know, Nagorno-Karabakh or whether it's southern Turkmenistan along the Afghan border. I know the Majlis podcast has done some great reporting on what's happening there in Russia's role in all of that. So it has ways it can pressure these countries without, I would say, escalating to a localized military conflict. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and even these countries can find themselves in a situation where their best choice, their best alternative, is to accede to the cooperation, as we see in the last 8 years in particular, the withdrawal of American diplomatic power and prestige from the region, and the recent meeting in Baku that you're aware of trilaterally amongst the Russian, Azerbaijani, and Iranian, first the foreign ministers, then the transportation ministers, seeking to build a transportation corridor. It's just starting to happen, perhaps not quite so much in Central Asia, but one can see it underway even in the South Caucasus.
Right.
Yeah, you're right.
There might not be a chance of a major escalation. Little Central Asian countries might not stand the chance to oppose the Russian view politically, militarily, whatever. But again, there are serious chances. Like last year, I believe, Bruce, you remember, Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan was almost there in a military confrontation on the argument over the offshore energy fields, which Azerbaijan calls Kapaz, Turkmenistan calls Serdar. So what's the possibility of a real conflict in a smaller level there? I mean, I know Hussein Aryan has some comment on that, but let's start, Bruce, with you.
If you're talking about a conflict between Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan, I would say it's pretty minimal, actually. Obviously, there's a lot of things at work here. The first being that, you know, Azerbaijan probably has a little bit better naval force, such as it is, than Turkmenistan. For the most part, except for Russia and Iran, the naval forces of the other countries are more geared toward interdiction of smugglers and things like that. The Russian naval force in the Caspian Sea is the only one that we would consider like a traditional naval force, the only one that could project power across the sea. Iran's still lagging behind, so I don't see that there's a big potential for conflict. They make a lot of noise about it. And you got to remember that you know, some of these projects have, certainly on the Azerbaijan side, have foreign shareholders as part of the consortium. And just Turkmenistan, you know, BP being an example of a company that's real active offshore in Azerbaijan, is Turkmenistan going to risk the wrath of one of these international majors by causing a problem like this? Because Turkmenistan needs this kind of investment in the future too, and it would just send a bad signal. And like I said, I think Turkmenistan in the end would be on the losing end of this anyway. You know, fortunately, I see a lot more talks about cooperation than I do, the problems. I know they have, there's still the issue of these fields in the middle of the Caspian, but they've tended to smooth over those a lot more recently in the last, you know, 5-6 years. It was a major issue when the old men were there, when the Azov was in and Haidar Aliyev was in there. There was a lot of conflict about that. It breaks out every now and then, but it's isolated and a very short duration. And then they seem to move on and start talking about cooperation again right away. So I don't see any potential for this to escalate to anything more than possibly an exchange of angry words.
Mr. Aryan.
Well, funny that too often we heard from the leaders of the littoral states that the Caspian Sea was a sea for peace and cooperation. If it were only so. As we heard from other guests, Russia has the largest navy, nearly 150 vessels. Most of the exercises and drills conducted by Russia in the Caspian Sea is far beyond the agreements reached between the states with regard to maintaining security, fighting smugglers, search and rescue. It goes far beyond that. If we consider the number of frigates, for instance, that Russia has, and during the drills using all the systems that they based ashore and on board, and all of that goes far beyond that. Russia has the largest fishing fleet in the Caspian Sea. The largest country has the biggest share in terms of maritime transportation and also the biggest navy. So in a way, it's trying to actually show that Russia is the main player in the Caspian Sea, in spite of its current, you know, friendship with the Islamic Republic of Iran. We've also seen Russian, as we heard from other guests, using the Caspian Sea for firing missiles against targets in Syria. Iran is doing more or less the same. But at the moment, because of the cooperation between Russia and Iran with regard to Syria and other matters, there have been a lot of coming and going ships, Russian ships visiting Iran, Iranian ships visiting Astrakhan, Iranian ships visiting Baku, and so on and so forth. But I think underneath all that, there is also a kind of desire by some other countries to develop their navy, as we've seen with Azerbaijan. We heard from Bruce that Azerbaijan navy has, you know, is developing better than probably other countries, getting help from the United States of America, from Israel, in terms of its command control, radar stations, you know, ashore Turkmenistan is doing the same, Kazakhstan is doing the same. So underneath all these cooperation and peace, they're developing their own navy for some kind of insurance to protect their own rights, their own share of the Caspian Sea when the countries get there. So there is some kind of a sort of very slow trend of militarization, as far as I can see, in the Caspian Sea.
Interesting point. So what is the ultimate end in this dispute? Any light at the end of the tunnel, Dr. Kutler?
Well, it seems that the old Soviet language about peace and friendship among peoples based on economic cooperation is not necessarily the canard it once seemed to be. It certainly could provide that kind of framework, but the hardball politics seem to be preventing it from doing so. I think that one can look forward to a continued irresolution, or lack of resolution of the situation for some years to come, at least until, say, let us say, the middle of the next decade, when any of these pipeline projects has the chance to become a reality.
Brief comments from each of guests, please. Lokofi?
Well, I'm not optimistic this issue is going to be resolved, and I look forward to discussing it again in about 10 or 15 years' time and pretty much saying everything I said today. but in all seriousness, thank you for having me on today's Mejlis podcast.
Thank you, Hussein, Aryan, and Bruce Panier.
Right, I'll start. I think, to be honest, if the issues between Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan resolve with regard to the Kopets or Sardar fields and other issues, Iran will be in a position that cannot do anything about it unless it changes its stance. But at the same time, the people of Iran, I must say that, and from what I read, are very worried about the capability of Iranian government to protect their interest in the Caspian Sea. But without changing its stance, Iran, as we heard from other guests, we'll probably be talking about the same thing in the next decade. It's not going to be resolved.
But also consider Iran is kind of slowly integrating to Western world. And also, who knows about how long Putin is going to stay in power, which there is an era after Putin in Russia. So position might change with Putin is gone. So Bruce, I'm trying to intrigue you to get some positive comment on that.
Yeah, okay. I can do that. Yeah. The current situation suits a lot of the actors, the littoral states who are involved in this. But the plain fact is that even were Turkmenistan to be able to build this pipeline and stuff, the market is there. And it doesn't really cut anybody out. Everyone knows that the European Union needs more gas and that need is going to increase in the next decade and past that. So it's not a question of buy my gas rather than the other guy's gas. There's enough room for everyone to ship gas and oil to these places. And it's just going to take, I suppose, some level of confidence on the part of some of these other governments that they're not going to get cut out of their share of the market because these other projects are going to come online because, in fact, there's plenty of customers out there to buy all this stuff.
Mohammed, this is Robert Cutler. May I add one more thing?
Yes.
I didn't mean to. It wasn't my intention to launch a descent into pessimism. So I do wish to contribute to the forward-looking, optimistic final comments very briefly. First, that to clarify, the dispute over the territory between Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan over the Kepa Sedar field is no obstacle to the construction of the undersea pipeline. It is entirely possible, and I believe that Turkmenistan published a government statement some years ago to this effect, that they can simply agree to disagree over that and build the pipeline, or they can decide alternatively to develop it together. But, for example, the UK and Norway have an existing dispute over the delimitation of the waters of the North Sea, but they went ahead and built a pipeline anyway. that's possible to do.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Robert Kotler, International Energy Consultant, for taking part in Majlis discussion today. And also Luke Coffey, Director of Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. And also Hussein Aryan, Independent Iranian Analyst. And Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlag Awazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, was joining us from New York today. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining the debate.
Okay, thank you. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you all.
Take care, Bruce.
You take care, too. It's good to talk to you.
Okay.
Good to meet you, Luke Coffey.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis. Until next week, bye-bye.